طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning everyone and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. We ask our listeners, as we do every week, were you involved last week in the Palestine-Israel peace movement and the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's savage military attacks against them to force them out of their homes and annex their properties into Israel? Did you speak out on the atrocities Israel is committing every day in Gaza and the West Bank? If not, what is your reason not to? It is Sunday, August 2nd, 2009. We begin with a summary of news highlights. The issue of illegal Israeli settlements is still very much at center stage. We recall that at a press conference following a meeting on May 27, 2009, with an Egyptian delegation consisting of Egyptian Foreign Minister Ahmed Ali Abulghait, Chief of the Egyptian General Intelligence Services Lieutenant General Omar Suleiman, and others, Secretary Hillary Clinton declared, and I quote, "With respect to settlements, the President was very clear when Prime Minister Netanyahu was here. He wants to see a stop to settlements. Not some settlements, not outposts, not natural growth exceptions. We think it is in the best interests of the effort that we are engaged in that settlement expansion cease. That is our position. That is what we have communicated very clearly, not only to the Israelis, but to the Palestinians and others, and we intend to press that point." Unquote. About a week later, on June 4th, President Obama gave a speech in Cairo, in which he appeared to press for the end of all settlement constructions. But his exact words regarding settlements were the following: "The United States does not accept the legitimacy of continued Israeli settlements," unquote. Notice how he used the word "continued" to refer to Israeli settlements. That was not accidental. It was a deliberately chosen vague word subject to interpretation in the best tradition of sly, lawyerly language in which Mr. Obama excels, having been trained in the best Ivy League schools. The Israelis, equally expert in parsing language, immediately stepped into the breach when almost 2 weeks later, on June 17th, at a press conference with Israeli Foreign Minister Lieberman at her side, Secretary Clinton repeated the demand she had made before the Cairo speech for the end of all settlement construction. Mr. Lieberman protested, saying that exceptions must be allowed for the so-called natural growth of settlements. With just a little reflection, we can see why the thought of asking for that exception is totally wacko. Think about it. Yes, the settlements are considered illegal under international law. Yes, they were and continue to be built on land acquired by armed robbery from their rightful Palestinian owners and military-backed demolition of Palestinian homes. But now that many of them have been built, provision must be made for their expansion. Sheer lunacy, isn't it? And yet, Mr. Obama's own words deliberately left open that possibility. Natural growth, so-called natural growth, construction of existing settlements, is technically not new settlement construction. As a matter of fact, according to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, the United States is expected to agree to the construction of 2,500 units currently under construction, which Israel believes cannot be halted. These units are also technically not new construction because they were planned and construction had started before the pronouncements of Secretary Clinton and President Obama. Got it? To understand what is going on, you've got to dissect every sentence, parse every word, uncover the number of ways every word can be twisted to mean the opposite of what most normal people understand is being said. Mr. Obama and his gang are not to be trusted. With all the promise of change, all they have done in every sphere is perpetuate George Bush's policies. In the same article we mentioned earlier, Haaretz reported that Secretary Clinton told European foreign ministers that Israel will agree to temporarily freeze construction of settlements, quote, in the framework of new understandings that Jerusalem will reach with Washington, unquote. She also said, according to Haaretz, that she expected the European Union to show support and appreciation for the move by Israel. Now, isn't that nice? Israel should be rewarded for temporarily suspending its criminal activities. What other deceits should we expect from the Obama administration within the so-called framework of new understandings that Jerusalem will reach with Washington? A clue to what awaits us can be found in Mr. Obama's meeting on July 13th with 15 American Jewish leaders in the White House. Again, according to Haaretz, quote, the president and the Jewish officials huddled for talks aimed at clearing the air following allegations that his administration was taking a tough line with Israel over settlement activity. At the meeting, Obama told the leaders that he wants to help Israel overcome its demographic problem by reaching an agreement on a two-state solution, but that in order to do so, Israel would need to engage in serious self-reflection. End of quote. We have to wonder what Mr. Obama's view of the two-state solution is, given the fact that he himself regards Palestinians as a demographic problem, and that he is giving the green light to more settlement construction on Palestinian land. It certainly looks as if Obama's nightmarish vision of a two-state solution is a more sliced-up version of the West Bank than even former Prime Minister Ariel Sharon engineered. Soon after the July 13th meeting at the White House, a group of Israeli rabbis, headed by Chief Rabbi Shlomo Amar, sent a letter to the United States rabbis and the President's conference, urging them to exert political leverage in Israel's favor. The letter said, and I quote again, "We ask you to make use of your political power to lobby the American authorities to reconsider this policy in the spirit of truly democratic justice." Unquote. So there you have it. The Israel lobby in the United States has received its marching orders from Israel to pressure the president to accept further settlement construction in the spirit of truly democratic justice. On which side of the looking glass are we living? Meanwhile, a group of legal experts from Israel's foreign ministry is writing a defense brief for the government ahead of two United Nations reports that are expected to be highly critical of the extent of civilian injuries in the Gaza Strip during the operation. A draft of the two reports is expected to be given to Israel around the end of August before they are officially presented to the United Nations Human Rights Council in mid-September. The release of the United Nations reports could lead to legal action against Israel. The first of the two reports, considered the harshest critique since the war, is being compiled by an investigative committee chaired by Judge Richard Goldstone, appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva. The second report is under preparation by the UN Commission on Human Rights. Legal experts in the Foreign Ministry told the Special Ministerial Committee following suits against the Israeli public figures abroad and various reports on Operation Cast Lead that they believe the release of the two UN reports could lead to legal proceedings against Israel or individual Israeli public figures in the International Court of Justice or the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Would that it were so. Hamas's political bureau chief Khaled Mashal reportedly told Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Saltanov in Damascus that if Palestinian Authority President Abbas comes to an agreement on a final settlement of the conflict with Israel, and if the agreement is approved in a Palestinian referendum, Hamas would not try to derail such an accord. When Minister Saltanov relayed Mr. Mashal's message to the Israelis, they predictably dismissed it and criticized Mr. Saltanov for meeting with Mr. Mashal, as they have done with former U.S. President Jimmy Carter when he relayed the same message to them last year. We expect to hear Israel very soon claim that it cannot negotiate a peace treaty with Mr. Abbas because Mr. Abbas cannot speak for the Palestinians in Gaza. On the ground, probably to curry favor with the United Nations, whose scathing reports are due to come out next month, Israel has authorized a one-of-a-kind shipment of 130,000 metric tons of cement and building materials into Gaza for the reconstruction of a flour mill and the repair of some sewage, electricity, and water facilities. The flour mill will be reconstructed in partnership with the United Nations Works and Relief Agency, or UNRWA. To curry favor with the United States, Israel has also suspended the construction of some 900 apartments in East Jerusalem. The houses were planned for the illegal settlement of Pisgat Zeev, built on Palestinian land in the West Bank around East Jerusalem. The big event in Palestine next week is the convening of the 6th Fatah Congress in Bethlehem this coming Tuesday, August 4th. The results of this Congress may have very far-reaching effects on the Palestinian political landscape. Interestingly, many of Mr. Abbas's opponents may not be able or allowed to enter and attend that conference. You may recall that we reported last week on Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman's instructions to all Israeli embassies and consulates to hang a 1940s picture of the then Grand Mufti of Jerusalem sitting with Hitler in a clear attempt to smear the Palestinians and muster public support for Israel. While it is true that the Grand Mufti appealed to Hitler in desperation of watching the Zionist British alliance rape his country, it is also true that former Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, then the operations commander of the notorious terrorist group of thugs known as the Stern Gang, who were responsible for many massacres of Palestinians, sent emissaries to Beirut to meet with German agents and offer the services of the Zionist military to Nazi Germany. Indeed, there is a long history of Zionist collaboration with the Nazis. That history has been carefully hidden from public view. Today, we have the privilege of exploring that history with Professor Mazen Qumsiyah. Professor Qumsiyah currently teaches and does research at Bethlehem and Birzeit universities in occupied Palestine and is president of the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People. He has had a long and distinguished career, having previously served on the faculties of Yale University, Duke University, and the University of Tennessee. He has published several books, of which the most acclaimed is Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights, and the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle, which was translated to Spanish. The book explores the history of Zionism and is available online at his website, www.qumsiyah, spelled Qumsiyeh.org. He joins us now by telephone from Palestine. Good afternoon, Professor Mazen Qumsiyah. Thank you
for
being
here. Good afternoon to you, and thanks for having me on your show.
On the contrary, it's our pleasure, sir. The long history of Zionist collaboration with Nazi Germany is well known to professional historians, but is rarely, if ever, discussed outside academic circles. As you know, Israeli Foreign Minister Lieberman instructed all Israeli embassies and consulates to display the picture of Mufti Hosseini sitting with Hitler. Comfortable in the notion that the public is ignorant of the Zionist collaboration with Nazi Germany. Could you give us a primer on the other side of this coin, the nature and extent of the Zionist connection with Hitler's Germany?
Yes, actually the connection started very early on in the Nazi regime when Hitler was first elected in the early 1930s. The World Zionist Organization and the Zionist Federations of Germany both sent him telegrams of congratulations and support, knowing very well his views as articulated in his book about Jews in Europe and things like that. And then when Hitler introduced the racial laws in Germany, the Zionist Federation of Germany further congratulated him and said that basically what he is trying to do in Germany is analogous to what they plan to do for Palestine. That is establish a national unified identity that excludes others who are different. And so in that sense, they fully approved what he did. And the relationship continued and became stronger in the mid-1930s and late 1930s when there was a boycott of Nazi Germany, and the Zionist movement broke the boycott and developed what was called the transfer agreement, which we can delve more deeply into if you like. And the relationship went further on up until the 1941-42, when, as you pointed out earlier, the high officials of the Nazi regime were invited to Haifa as the guest of the Haganah and other underground Zionist forces, and continued up until the end, basically, up until the end of the Nazi regime.
How about the transfer movement that you had mentioned a couple of minutes ago? What was that about?
So as the world boycotted Nazi Germany and Nazi products, the Nazi regime began to feel the economic pressure. And the boycott was supported by socialist Jews like the Bund and other socialist organizations. The Zionist movement, by contrast, decided that it is wise to seek alliance and seek arrangements with Hitler. So they approached the Nazi regime about facilitating Jewish immigration to Palestine. That is, members of the Jewish community in Germany and in the concentration camps from Eastern Europe who are Zionist and would be willing to come to Palestine under the banner of Zionism could exchange basically their goods in Germany for money that they would spend in Palestine on German goods. It was a win-win kind of situation for the Zionist movement and the Nazis, so to speak. For the Zionist movement, it meant getting these people that supported the Zionist movement to come to Palestine. And for the Nazi movement, it meant basically a market for its products, then in boycott around the world, and the support of the Zionist movement of very wealthy and rich individuals like Rothschilds and Weizmanns of the world to support basically a break on the boycott of Nazi Germany. In the process, of course, that had the implicit agreement by the Zionists that other Jews who are not supportive of the Zionist movement, and especially socialist and communist Jews who are not interested in immigrating to Palestine but are interested in going to Europe, other places in Europe, or the United States, that those Jews would be not of their concern, that the Nazi Germany could do whatever it wants to with these other Jews, so to speak, which happened to be the majority of Jews, because the Zionist movement was very small at the time. So essentially, in a nutshell, the movement was, or the agreement, what was called the Ha'avara Agreement, or the Transfer Agreement, was an agreement that benefited Nazi Germany and that benefited the Zionist project on the expense of Jewish lives in Europe.
That it is amazing how much the Zionist movement oppressed Jews in Europe with the idea of forcing them to emigrate into Palestine. And that continued after the war in 46, 47, and the camps of the displaced persons. Didn't that not happen there? Where the Zionist movement compelled young men and unaccompanied children to go to Palestine and separated them from their families to force them to go to Palestine and fight against the Palestinians. Also during the war was, if I may, and you refer to this somewhere you have referred to this as there were two envoys that Yitzhak Shamir, who was then operations commander of the Stern Gang, there were two emissaries that he sent to Beirut, and with a proposal. That proposal was found in the archives of the German embassy in Ankara. In that document, let me, if I may, quote a point that was made in that document, and I quote, "The establishment of the historical Jewish state on a national and totalitarian basis and bound by a treaty with the German Reich would be in the interest of a maintained and strengthened future German position of power in the Middle East." So while the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem was desperately looking for help to end the carnage and rape of his land, Israel would offer the Wehrmacht power and influence in the Middle East. This was far more insidious than the appeal to end the carnage in Palestine that the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem was trying to make to Hitler.
Yes, the Mufti of Jerusalem was actually at the time expelled from Palestine. He was out of Palestine, and he was out trying to gain alliances against the British more than anything else, who had occupied Palestine then for over 20 years. That was his main aim, and so his logic was the enemy of my enemy is my friend, sort to speak, or try to be friends. But this was not the case for the Zionist movements in Palestine, which were very strong in Palestine, had strong alliances with the British, and yet secret alliances with the Nazi movement. And the alliances were interested very much in basically expelling the Palestinians and in bringing Jews of Europe to Palestine.
As you refer also in your book, Professor Kumsia, what Ben-Gurion, who was then in the leadership of the Zionist movement, when there was an opportunity to save thousands of Jewish children in 1938, told a meeting of labor Zionist leaders,
there was a proposal to bring Jewish children from Germany and from the areas under German control in 1938, before things got bad, to bring them to England. Mm-hmm. And Ben-Gurion stood very strongly against it, as were most of the leaders of what was then called the Yishuv, which is the Zionist settlement movement in Palestine. And in this meeting of leaders of the Yishuv, he told them why he was opposed to this. He said, you know, if I had the chance to save all the children in Germany, Jewish children in Germany, by taking them to England, and only half of them by bringing them to Eretz Israel, you know, to the land of Palestine then I would choose the latter, because we should not put the interests of these children ahead of Jewish history and the Zionist project. This was the essence of his statement, that basically he was willing to sacrifice Jewish children by preventing them from going to places like England and the United States if the other alternative is get some of them into Palestine. That was the main goal of Ben-Gurion and his movement. And basically the Zionist movement set this course very early on in the 1930s, that they would rather Jews come to Palestine than be liberated, go live anywhere else comfortably, that Palestine was the place for them. So they actually instituted a program to close the doors for Jewish migration from areas in which they are persecuted to any other country, and leave them basically one door open, which is to come and join the Zionist movement in the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. So because of that, the Zionist movement lobbied Western governments like England, Australia, other places, the United States certainly, and Canada, to prevent Jewish immigration into those countries and not allow them to expand the quotas. This is another little known fact about the history in which the Zionists claimed that they were doing what they were doing to help Jews, when in reality there's now ample documentary evidence that they lobbied, for example, the United States government against Jewish migration into the United States, against expanding the quotas for immigrants, for Jewish refugees from Europe to come to the United States.
Yes, and not only that, they would react violently to Jews who were against the idea of Zionism. Did they not develop that equation Jew equals Zionist, with the idea that if you were a Jew and were not a Zionist, then you were a traitor, and that would justify violent action against fellow Jews?
Yes, and this paradoxical situation where they both claim to represent Jews, but at the same time were willing to sacrifice any Jews who opposed them. It is almost reminiscent of the Sakari movement against the Roman, the Jewish movement that was so extreme and so radical. They called them Sakari because they would hide their daggers under their cloaks and would stab and kill anybody, Jewish, Roman, or anybody who opposed their views. And they are the ones who led in their extremist movement to basically the Romans finally cracking down on them. This extremism has reached unprecedented levels in the 1940s, of course, when even some rabbis that were anti-Zionists were murdered by Zionists. And when the Zionist movement in the 1950s put some bombs in front of synagogues and Jewish community centers in Iraq, for example, to scare Iraqi Jews into leaving to Palestine in false flag operations, this again shows the disregard for life generally, and of course Jewish life included, just to achieve a political end. This became a standard bearer structure of the Zionist movement, that violence is the way to achieve political ends. And that's where the violence of Israel stems from, is from these very early movements of using Zionism to coerce Jews and non-Jews alike to accept their ideologies and to support their ideologies.
Yet, you know, this equation, Jew equals Zionist, survives until today, and in fact has found its way in the dictionary, that if you're an anti-Zionist, you are an anti-Semite. Yet we see from the documentary record that Zionism is, if anything, almost the antithesis of Judaism.
Well, I am not sure about, I would go that far. Judaism, like any religion, has various strands in it. And I think Zionism represents a particular understanding of Judaism. For the Zionists, that's how they perceive it. In the same way that Osama bin Laden assumes that his philosophy represents an understanding of Islam. Their idea, you can find some support for it in certain writings, and certainly you can find some opposition to it in certain biblical writings. So these are the kinds of things that go under the interpretation, so to speak, of a religious text, in which extremists have used religious texts to justify their activities. But by and large, Zionists have not been religious. Ben-Gurion himself hated religious Jews. He called them dogs and things like that. And most Zionists were secular atheists who adopted Zionism as an alternative religion, almost, as an alternative philosophy to understand the world, so to speak, right? This historically is not unusual for humans to do that when they want to support a particular political ideology. The Crusaders certainly used Christianity in the same sense when they were butchering Muslims, Jews, and also fellow Christians who didn't happen to belong in the right category of Christianity, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So it is found in history. I would say that the Zionist movement was a bit more extreme in the way it applied these idiotic principles and used them through violence to achieve political ends.
Well, that's when you get God in the, when you get God into the picture, everything else falls apart. Who wants to debate God? And that's you, I mean, one can find anything in the scriptures, in the Bible, in the Torah, in the Quran. You can find proposition A and proposition not A. Anything you wish can be found in the scriptures.
Exactly.
What other things can you tell us? Well, I'd like to try and get beyond the Zionist rule that is in effect in Israel. In fact, if we are to understand this government, this Israeli government, we need to know its roots. The Likud and other parties are really byproducts of Jabotinsky's movement, the revisionist. Do they follow, basically, they follow Jabotinsky's ideas, do they not? I mean, much has been made of the Hamas constitution, if you will. But what of the Likud?
Yes, we have to understand that Likud and Kadima today also trace their ideological foundations with Vladimir Jabotinsky. Vladimir Jabotinsky in the 1920s founded what's called revisionist Zionism, and the only thing he revised about Zionism is really the way it's presented and the way it's acted upon. His view, unlike Ben-Gurion, was that Zionism can be achieved only by force of arms, without any use for international treaties, diplomatic gestures, language or verbal things, gymnastics, etc. Ben-Gurion, by contrast, believed in the use of both violence and diplomatic and other activities. So the only difference was not in the goals of these two movements, the traditional labor Zionism and the Jabotinsky revisionist Zionism, but in the tactics they used to achieve these goals. Both of them aimed for a Jewish state. Both of them aimed to remove the Palestinians from their land. Because Jabotinsky was more focused on direct violence, he was more interested in any kind of collaboration or any benefit with any kind of movement or government, regardless of how fascist or how arrogant or how anti-democratic it was. In fact, his black shirt people that the military under his command, the militia under his command, imitated in dress and in walk and in gestures the fascist movement in Italy and admired the fascist movement in Italy of Mussolini and things like that. And they also sought alliances with them because, again, they believed that just like them, these fascists believed in the power of the military. And so we can build alliance with them, that the blitzkrieg that Germany is doing is exactly the kind of thing we should be doing in Palestine, is his reasoning and his logic. Now, Ben-Gurion was a little more cautious, but again, tried to achieve the same goals in different ways. And as I mentioned earlier, the Haganah and the Yishuv leadership that's more mainstream was willing to talk to Hitler and to make deals with Hitler, like the transfer agreement, but to do it in more careful, behind-the-scenes, secretive ways, not up in your face as Jabotinsky and his ideological descendants now do. People like Avigdor Lieberman and Shamir and Sharon and Netanyahu are the ideological descendants of Jabotinsky.
Well, if we are to achieve any kind of just settlement of this violence against Palestinians, how are we to go from a Zionist era, which we are in now, through the Likud and Avigdor Lieberman's party, Beitenu Yisrael, or something? What are your thoughts about a post-Zionist era, and how one can get to that era?
Well, we face a very hard problem here. We Palestinians today are 10 million or 11 million Palestinians. 7 million of us are refugees or displaced people. And we face one of the most organized, best organized, best financed, best structured colonial settlement projects in history. I mean, the British in India, or the French in Algeria, or the Spanish in Portugal, or whatever, the Portuguese in Africa, were nothing compared to the Zionist movement here in terms of its structure, organization, meticulous planning, etc. So we face a very, very strong enemy. But I believe that it is not a foreclosed conclusion that the Palestinians will continue to suffer loss of land and suffer at the hands of the Zionists. I think actually if we look historically, we can get some encouragement from the fact that the only places where colonial movements really succeeded is when they wiped off the natives completely or semi-completely, so that there's not enough of them left to really mount an effective resistance. And those who are left are manageable. And I am thinking here of places like the United States, Canada, Australia, where the native population is so small and so manageable that the society can be expected to be safely continued development under the majority rule that exists there. Where this didn't happen, where the natives were not obliterated completely or semi-completely, we find that the last six decades basically have showed that people do get their freedoms. And in fact, Israel is the only place where this has not happened yet. And I'm thinking here of places like Algeria, like South Africa, like most countries in Africa itself, Rhodesia previously, now Zimbabwe, and things like that. So Israel remains as the only one in which the native population still exists in very, very large numbers. And the colonizers are having a tough time, and I think they are having a tough time. And I think the paranoia of what we started with this conversation is about Lieberman sending the picture, the old picture of 1940 or whatever, of Hitler with the Mufti of Jerusalem, shows a kind of desperation on the part of the Zionist movement. When you resort to resurrecting a 63-year-old picture to buttress your cause as you are killing Palestinians and settling their land today, it shows an act of desperation, I think.
It shows on their part an act of desperation, but
that's right.
On the other hand, as you made the point, in time, even though the populations were not totally obliterated, but time, in what way is time acting? Is time acting on the side of Palestinians, or is it acting on the side of Israelis?
I definitely think it's acting on the side of the Palestinians. If you look today, between River Jordan and the Mediterranean, there are 5.5 million Palestinians and an approximately equal number of Israeli Jews. And many of the Israeli Jews, I would say more than half of them, are not Zionist, are either post-Zionist or even anti-Zionist. Mm-hmm. So, and the Palestinians are reproducing fairly rapidly in this area. And so the Zionist movement had run out of large numbers of Jews around the world to bring here. Certainly Russian Jews were the largest number, 1 million that were brought in the 1990s. But this has ended basically, and now, or 1980s and 1990s. And now there's a reverse migration. Over 300,000 Israelis have moved from Israel to the United States. Over 250,000 Israelis are now living in Germany even. So I think, you know, we can see that the trends are not, good for Zionism long term. And the other aspect, I think the second point to make about that, is the use of military power and military might to achieve political ends have also been curtailed significantly in the last 20 years. And even more so in the last 5 or 6 years. I would say take the example of the Israeli attack in Lebanon in 2006 or the Israeli attack on Gaza just this past year, and you will see that that military might cannot achieve political ends. Israel was not successful in what it aimed to achieve with these military campaigns against Lebanon and against the Gaza Strip. So I think at this point, all the Israeli Zionist establishment has left to it is its military power, and that has been shown to be basically not too useful to achieve its political ends. So it has to come now with time being on the side of justice and human rights for Palestinians. I'm very convinced of this. I think in the next 10 years, we'll see dramatic changes here.
Well, I'm glad that we can end this interview on an optimistic note. Thank you very much, Professor Mazen Qumsiyah, for being our guest today. The issue...
Thank you.
The Zionist... The subject of Zionism is a very broad subject, and perhaps we can continue our discussion in another edition. Thank you very much. And that is all we have for today.
You.
It's our pleasure, Mazen. And that is all we have for today. We wish our listeners a pleasant and restful weekend and look forward to having you with us next week, same time. Until then, this is Sharif Fahm signing off for now and reminding our listeners to get involved. Get involved.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيمي